today.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'd like to open the Senate Committee on Healthcare.
And I will call the House Committee on Healthcare together for this joint meeting. We'll be meeting for 45 minutes in this room, and then for the committee, for the House Committee on Healthcare, we'll be moving next door at 4 o'clock for the last piece of business.
Okay, I'm going to open an informational meeting on the update on the merger of PEB and OEB. And I see a panel in front of me, so I assume you're going to start us off.
We are, Madam Chair. I'm the kickoff speaker. For the record, Betsy Johnson, State Senator from District 16. Let me set the scene that brings us here today. At the end of the 2017 session, a legislative work group was convened to examine potential cost reduction, avoidance, and options in order to help reduce cost increases in future budgets and to institute prudent financial practices and principles for state government. The measure, Senate Bill 1067, is a compilation of actions related to that work and other proposals. So today we're here to talk about a couple of elements of 1067, specifically the requirement for PEB and OEB, and for people that are listening, the Public Employees Benefit Board and the Oregon Educators Benefit Board, to establish an executive committee, and we are three of those members, and you will hear more about the composition of the committee from my colleagues, but to establish an executive committee to develop a plan for the merger of the boards and to begin a combined administrative function and operations. The bill also required PEB and OED to adopt methodologies designed to limit growth in premium or per member health costs to 3.4% a year. There were other things that the bill did, but we are principally here today to report on the work of this executive committee. There are slides to accompany this, and I will resist the temptation to read my portions of it other than to say that this was an interesting group to work with. I think it was a very balanced group. It brought expertise from PEB in the person of Sean. It brought expertise from OEB. We worked, I believe, very collaboratively, and we're required by the bill to report our results to you in this short session. And it is to that purpose that we are here today. And I will just describe the membership so that you get a sense of the expertise that we drew. Sean Parkman, who is the PEB vice chair, Jeff Brown, the chair of the OEB board, Marie Moss Anderson, the OEB vice chair, Rob Gallinat from Lapine, who faithfully made the meetings, even in some of the most wretched weather. He was an absolute stalwart. John Larson from the OEB board, Mark Perlman, the PEB board, Bill Barr, the PEB board, and I was the legislative liaison in a non-voting capacity. So with that tee up and the fact that we started with a set of goals agreed to by the committee to try to reduce overall costs as prescribed in 1067, create efficiencies as described in 1067, eliminate duplication, and for many of us who viewed this as a somewhat simpler exercise than it turned out to be, having two benefit programs, one OEB, one PEB, was sort of the starting point, and simplistically believed, well, we'll just push them together and that'll be that. Not so much. This turned out to reveal the complexities involved in the conversation. And finally, an agreement together that we would try to maintain a member group focus in order, as many of our colleagues reminded us, that the efficiencies and the cost savings should not be carved out of the members of both PEB and OEB. So with those very high-level introductory remarks, I'll get to bat last when my two much more learned colleagues present the meat of our discussions. But I would simply say again with emphasis, I think many of us came into this with the naive perception that this was going to be a simple conversation. And it proved quite the contrary, and it was a genuine education for many to realize the complexities of these two systems and how they may fit together ultimately. So with that, Madam Chair, I will turn it over to my colleagues to get into the substance of our work product.
Thank you, Senator.
Good afternoon. I'll start on page 6 since that's where
Please
we are.
Please introduce yourself.
Yes, my name is Jeff Brown. I'm chair of OEB. And other than that, I'm retired, but formerly a health plan consultant for 38 years. Sufficient. Thank you. Well, kicking off as we review OEB and PEB, looking at the background on 6, what comes to mind is exploring the differences between the two groups and what some of the challenges would be in merging them straight out. OEB insures over 240 school districts, ESDs, and counties, whereas PEB is more focused on state employees. So the structure for employer contributions is different. Within OEB, we offer the choice of plans that the various entities select for their groups. It can be one, it can be all, but the job of OEB is to provide value-added quality plans for choice, much like an exchange. PEB more directly represents the end users, their members. Similarly, contributions are determined differently. With OEB, the contributions are determined out at the individual entity. With PEB, it's done as part of the board function, I believe. As I mentioned, OEB does function as an exchange, and there are well over 300 different bargaining groups that select plans in OEB. So it really does make it really Oregon's first exchange in many respects, and has worked well since inception. Next page. The challenges from the analysis of our differences and the opportunities for merger is putting them directly together has a high risk for member and program disruption. It also has some interesting subtleties in terms of managing potential cost escalation. And then we have to pay attention to, or we feel honor-bound to pay attention to, meaning stakeholder engagement and satisfaction. And when we really delved into it, the opportunities for overall savings just really weren't there when we looked at it. It was about 0.5%. Next page. After several discussions facilitated by an outside trained group facilitator, the group explored different ways of merging the two organizations and narrowed it down to 3 models that we could go deeper in. And the first one is on the following page, which is the more simplified direct merger, perhaps the most literal of the merging them together. Complexities in that is that it really aligns all of the duties into one large group. My master's degree is in behavioral science and communication, and I know that the more channels of communication that are open, the slower a group moves. It would necessarily require reforming the board, rechartering, and restructuring the governance. We felt this to be a pretty cumbersome model of the 3 that we entertained. The second option on the next page is an emphasis on joint governance. It retains the 2 individual boards, but in a more limited capacity, charging those 2 boards primarily with benefit design, pricing, and carriers selection, and aligns under the joint governance board the operations, communications, wellness initiatives, and other non-risk contractual services. So that would be engaging a health savings account administrator, those things that are purely transactional and have no insurance joined with them. The third option that we explored put its major emphasis on innovation. In this case, what we did is, instead of building the governance together at the top, we put in between the two boards a joint innovation work group. This is has some roots in the OEB strategies, evidence and outcomes work group model, where ways to build more efficiency, to encourage people to better use of their benefits, ways to make it more efficient, are explored and then recommended to the board. In this case, instead of having a subgroup serving one board, we'd have a joint group with 2 to 4 members from each board. But in addition to just having members from the boards, we would welcome in participation from OHA, from the legislature. We built into our model that there would be a representative for at least discussion from the Senate, from the House. And what's promising about this model is we would hope that instead of having one group in one place, another group operating in another, and another group operating that way, that we would have some synchronization and cohesion in discussing those topics of interest. It's also proposed that those experts from various elements or parts of the healthcare delivery system be brought in on a testimony basis, so we don't have any special interest in a voting capacity. And we think this really provides a lot of opportunity for interaction and pulling in expertise from a number of ways without then again bloating or overly enlarging this innovation work group. As you go down in that model, you can see that there is a shared services group. And again, this oversees those services that are more readily combined. It looks for marketing, for obtaining proposals for services that are non-risk related, working with staff in terms of operations, et cetera. So after looking at these three models, we created a comparison with key points. So in our areas of evaluation, we looked at cost savings. And across the board, you could say that really bringing these two pools together offer minimal savings. Both groups really have reached a level of size that provides most of the cost savings possible through their individual structures. There's another side element that goes with this. OEB is aligned with two carriers. PEB is aligned with two carriers. One on each of those is different. As we pursue these initiatives for more efficiency, cost savings, designs of delivery systems, we actually maximize by having two large purchasing groups that can forward these initiatives to two different platforms that reach out beyond these two boards and have the potential of influencing the balance of the state. It seems that there's been quite a bit of attention given to transforming the healthcare delivery system, and we think that this model really maximizes that opportunity utilizing the size of these two groups. Administratively, the savings were the same across all three models. The third item, bottom right hand, really restates that we think this has the highest level of potential savings through shared services and joint innovation. The next page, areas of evaluation, Model 1 as the lowest level of member group focus. Model 2 is somewhere in the middle, and option 3 is the highest level of member responsiveness with input from those people that we serve. Program flexibility and efficiency. Again, we gravitate towards the right side with option 3 having the highest level of flexibility. And that comes from the standpoint of how we're bargaining and how we're negotiating and the representation of the members, the users of the health plans. Program disruption is the lowest over on option 3, highest on the straight merger model. And board education becomes more of a challenge under a straight combination and has the least impact on our option 3. So I believe you've already think ahead to the conclusion of where we're headed is we are coming in to our report generally promotes the option 3. Sean?
Yes. Chair Greenlink, Chair Lemus Anderson, my name, members of the committee, my name is Sean Parkman. I'm the chair of the PEP board, and I was chair of this committee. As part of one thing that I don't think we mentioned explicitly is that all these slides that we're drawing from a full report that we have copies for the members of the committee if you don't already have one. And we knew that part of the interest in this discussion, or it was our understanding, that part of the interest by the legislature in this discussion, part of it was understanding the potential cost savings or impacts, the financial impacts of merging not just the boards, but also the risk pools of the boards. And so that has its own section in the report that if, for those that are following along with the full report with more detail and context, that's that starts around page 20 in the full report. And so Senate Bill 1067 required that we included that fiscal analysis in the report. We've already mentioned that part of this initiative was try to understand how we can contain costs, and the directives of both the OEB and the PEP boards is and has always been to provide affordable, comprehensive health insurance options at prices employees and employers can afford. So it's with that understanding that we have this analysis about the merging of these risk pools. So there were, as we've mentioned up to this point, some challenges determining the fiscal impacts given the differences between the different plans. Because of the differences in the way that OEB and PEB are designed, the benefits are designed, there were several choices that needed to be considered related to fully insured versus self-insured insurance options. So basically, PEB is largely self-insured. Its largest plan is self-insured. OEB is fully insured. And so when it comes to considering the risk pools together, one has to make the choice of, do you consider that OEB would become fully or self-insured, or would PEB become fully insured? And once that choice is made, there are consequences on cost savings, depending on which one you do. Or you can keep, you can keep a mixture, which would basically kind of cancel itself out because it would be more or less status quo. So option one is, sort of considering, making a hard decision of making both fully insured or self-insured. If OEB were to become self-insured, the analysis showed that there could potentially be some savings with that move. However, it would require an upfront investment of somewhere in the order of $60 to $70 million in order to create a reserve. So, you know, that's a hard choice. If PED were to become fully insured, the analysis showed that some of the cost savings that PED has been able to realize from its fully insured model would need to be given up, essentially. And some of the tools available to PED for cost savings would be sacrificed. There was the additional challenge that we've already mentioned, that was mentioned here as it relates to the challenge of coming up with a fiscal impact for all this, is that the plans, the plan years are on different cycles for OEB and PED. And that has some consequences about how you would move them to the same plan year as it relates to migrating one system to another for the purposes of fiscal impact. So with this analysis, the overall sort of bottom line on the fiscal impact was that the cost savings are fairly minimal. More minimal than we had anticipated when analyzing, and Jeff kind of went over this a little bit. The risk pools as they are now are large enough independently to sort of gain some efficiencies. Putting them together doesn't create a new level of efficiency in the market, or if it does, it's pretty minimal and washed out by some other factors. And so they ended up being basically less than 0.5% overall as far as potential cost savings. And the there are some cost savings to be had for merging the administrative functions of PED and OEB, but many of those, or not necessarily but, and many of those are already happening and will continue to happen. And so some of those cost savings have been realized. There could potentially be a slight benefit as well if PED and OEB had the same insurance carriers. But again, those cost savings would be very minimal. So, having gone through that fiscal analysis and realizing that through that merger process of the risk pools, hypothetically, there wasn't much to be saved, we also asked for, you know, what could save some money, and there we did find some opportunities that are more detailed in the report for those that are following along around page 24. Some areas of potential. The opportunities for savings would be generated by increased efficiencies of claims and utilization through benefit plan design, choice of plan offerings, utilization of disease management efforts, provider and pharmacy reimbursement models, and advancing the organized systems of care. The ability to pursue these opportunities with OEB and PED can be realized not by merging or mashing the two boards together, but rather through this innovative work group process, by the process of sharing data, best practices, and innovative partnerships between the two boards. So more explicitly, advancing coordinated care programs, supporting new payment methodologies, with providers and promoting efficient utilization of care by members are all opportunities that the two boards could explore together in this new structure. And it was our estimation that the Joint Innovation Work Group structure was a productive structure to pursue in order to capitalize on those opportunities that we identified. So more explicit direct information about the combining of the administrative functions of the boards. OEB and PEB have undertaken joint RFPs in the past for ancillary benefits and have experienced savings with expanded buying power in those circumstances. And we continue to pursue those joint RFPs where they make sense. OEB and PEB have already started the process of combining administrative staff, and both have experienced a reduction in FTE of 14%, including the executive management level, over recent years. You can see on the slide the 2015-17 budget versus the 17-19. So, the conclusion here is that the committee recommends model option number three. Senator Johnson, did you want to?
Just a couple of concluding remarks. let me take this back down to a much more elementary level. I think when I approached this assignment early on, it was, why don't you just push them together, and instead of 150,000 lives on one side and 150 on the other, push them together and you got the buying power of 300,000. Not so easy, as Mr. Parkman has explained, with two different kinds of benefit packages. Why have two actuaries? I don't know how expensive actuaries are, but it struck me as buying those kinds of consultancy services for PEB and OEB made no sense. As we moved through, it became a little bit more obvious why that might have some benefit. I think the thing that I came away with that is the most valuable of this whole undertaking was the notion of using this innovation group to get us some common data platforms. And it goes all the way from the simplest. We don't know, for example, how many wellness programs exist throughout both the offerings. We don't know what our plans are offering. We don't know what we're offering. We have layered over the top of it now a wellness coordinator. And we don't know how much they cost, where they're duplicative, what the usage is. And so this combined model that has been presented by my two colleagues as our report to the legislature would be the place to begin to gather that data. On the simplest, look at how many wellness providers there are. On the most complex, look at hospital utilization, for an example, and be able to draw some conclusions based on the data. So one of the things that I, and perhaps I'm allowing my own bias to slip into this, is that I think with the selection of the new administrator on the announced retirement of Ms. Loretz, that there is a greater role for the agency and there is a greater role for the legislature. The back rooms, in my opinion, and again, this is my opinion, ended up merged largely out of the default of having lost the OEB administrator, but there might be a role where the legislature could play a slightly accelerated role, and certainly the importance of PEB and OEB to the Oregon Health Authority cannot be understated. So I think we have brought you a pragmatic recommendation based on what we all learned together sitting in the hermetically sealed room for hour after hour. I want to particularly acknowledge Ali Hassan, who did the lion's share of the work here. I joked that we were going to open up his office one day and find him dead over the desk. He pounded out an enormous amount of data, did research at the request of this group, typed up endless draft reports, and his contribution cannot be underestimated. Ali, you made this group happen, so I want to acknowledge that in front of the legislature. So with that, we would be happy to take any, I get the mushball questions, my two colleagues get the hard ones. But again, I will say that I came into this conversation with a pretty advanced degree of naivete about how difficult this conversation was going to be. And originally, when we began to coalesce around the notion of this innovation, I was worried that we would prolong the discussions and not get down to the meat of it. I've now been completely convinced that having this shared data platform, the expertise of both boards feeding in serious data collection that will inform decisions going forward is exactly the prudent place to begin. And so with that, I think we've concluded our presentation, and we would be happy to take questions.
Okay, Representative Greenlee is going to start.
I just want to go backwards a little bit. I never did have the belief that merging the two risk pools would make a big difference, but could you run back through the notion of why a single expanded board, maybe having this innovation group reporting to it, doesn't work? Why two boards? Run through the analysis of why two boards is better than one single expanded board.
Well, I'll answer for the OEB side, and Sean can talk about the PEB side. The OEB board is formed with representation from a number of different points of view. There is a physician on the board. There are industry experts on the board. There are labor people on the board. There are management people on the board. And they are not lined up one for one. It is a broader base board charged with really coming to a conclusion of what presents the highest quality, most efficient plans for the schools and municipalities and so forth, ESDs, to choose from to offer to their employee groups. Our focus is on plan, the quality of the plans, and that's how the board is built. From an PEB perspective.
Yes, yeah, so one concept here, I think, is how large a board can be and still be a functional board. So if you end up with a board that's, you know, 20 some people, I think that can become a large board. The specialty or the specialization that the two boards have, I think, is something that the committee discussed for some time. The idea that the way that local school districts, for example, are choosing the plans, the negotiation cycle that is related to that was pretty alien to the members of the PEB board, which doesn't operate that. We have, for practical purposes, we kind of have one employer that we're considering, whereas OEB has hundreds. So that dynamic is very different, and it soon became apparent that the learning curve for the dynamics that go into that are considerable. And so, you know, basically, you know, when considering the efficiency of having one group versus two, you know, that's what this sort of analysis table in the report was trying to show is the criteria that we ran through in order to consider the three models. But the bottom line is that there's a good amount of fear that there would be a loss of that specialization that the two boards have for the needs of the constituents that they're serving.
Let me also offer what I'm going to consider a more lay perspective, not serving as a voting member of either of the boards. They are so different in their character. The PEB board is a 4-4 board, 4 labor, 4 management. And I think that there has been, and I would be corrected if my observation is erroneous, but I think that as there was any discussion about benefits, that the PEB board at this 4-4 split became quite anxious about a diminution of input into what would happen with member benefits. I would say that, again, in my observation, a 4-4 board has perhaps not always yielded the most dynamic results, but they are completely different in their structure, and until there is a political interest in changing the composition of those boards, it was not something that we felt our committee was empowered or capable of negotiating to a satisfactory conclusion.
Well, I have the honor of follow-up. I was sitting on that board with you as a non-voting member, and my impression is I frequently don't know which one is a management, which one is a labor representative. Occasionally it gets into issues of fringe benefit, but it seemed to me the expertise in managing these two very complex programs could easily be managed, not easily, could be adequately managed by one properly organized single board, even though they would essentially have two or maybe more than two programs. But it just intrigues me if we can integrate the management function without integrating the leadership function. It's an interesting concept. Thank you, Madam Chair.
I would just add, in conclusion, the executive branch would certainly, the governor's office specifically, would have to be participatory because these are gubernatorial appointees, and this is not something that the legislature will unilaterally decide.
Representative Vile, or do you want to follow up?
No, I'm done. Thank you.
Representative Vile and then Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think most of the questions I had were answered. I do want to express gratitude for whomever put this together. It was really helpful to me in looking at this. I was particularly interested in the fact that Washington, with a mushed system, seems to have 40% more people trying to run the thing than we do. And I'm wondering, and I think this is where you've kind of answered the question, if this is not a good example of where the bigger a system gets, the less efficient it tends to get, and maybe keeping these in a separate place is the better alternative.
I think that our experience, Representative Vile, over the summer with this executive committee, which was four board members from each board, and Representative Johnson participating in. Pardon?
Senator,
I'm sorry.
It's okay.
I'm sorry. I don't know why I'm nervous at 70 years old, but I do get nervous. is that we found it a fairly nimble organization. We were able to have direct dialogue and plow our way through the issues that had to be spoken. When we expand that group to be, there's 12 board members on OEB, things do in fact slow down. There is the need to express each individual's opinion, whether that's additive or not. That's the reality of way groups form. So we were able to move through this in about 5 months with very well-structured meetings and deliberately going through the salient points, compare and contrasting, and that led to this report. So the idea of a joint innovation work group with appointees from each board, of board members who have a particular interest in innovation and efficiency, promises to be one that's got a higher rate of engagement and enthusiasm and pursuit of good options.
We have 3 minutes to go. Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One, thank you very much for the work you did. I think it's a good work product, and I think it clearly outlines how complex the issue is, and I guess one of my observations is any change is going to have to be a fairly slow evolutionary change. But I think I'm inclined to agree with Representative Greenlee that it seems like if we knew what the direction was we're trying to go, and it's not entirely clear to me, that you might get there easier if you had a unified board to do that. One, the other option, it seems to me one of the problems we have with this is too many choices, which makes it very hard to get down to a restricted structure. And I guess one of the questions I'd have on that is what I've been told, and I don't know if it's accurate or not, is that we obviously, the legislature said, trying to put a cap on increases to 3.4%. Yet my understanding is that the current offerings by providers are running over 5%. And I guess the question would be is, how do you get to the legislative direction, you know, in that kind of a structure?
Senator Meyer, you asked a couple of questions here. One is, let me start with the easier one, choice. Choice of plans was mandated in Senate Bill 426, which established OEB. The fact that we have the opportunity to serve so many different entities is that allowing choice provides an entry point for those new groups electing to come into OEB. And so to be able to pick a plan that more closely resembles the current offerings gives them an easier inroad rather than radically changing everything in one fell swoop. Second question was, sorry.
Evolutionary change versus rapid.
To some degree, starting with the Joint Innovation Work Group, sharing conclusions that are applicable to both boards is a step towards a unified board. Could be viewed as that. Mm-hmm. Whereas we come to conclusions and we submit those to the separate boards, there would be a synergy and a push for that to be jointly adopted. And it's the business of this proposed Joint Innovation Work Group that I believe has the greatest opportunity to affect change. We've been changing deductibles and out-of-pocket maximums and which PPO network and these various things since 1978. I was in the business that long. Went through the whole HMO thing, just all that. What we really need to do is transform healthcare delivery. And this recommendation puts the emphasis on transforming how healthcare is delivered and then bringing that forth with recommendation to the respective boards. I think that's where there's greatest potential.
Unfortunately, we're out of time, and I know that Representative Hayden had a question, but we are Bueller. So we're going to need to adjourn because of another committee. I apologize. So I am I'm adjourning the Senate Health Care Committee, and you're.
Thing is that people are traumatized, right? And we trigger when something happens again and again.
Hearing we're having this morning came at the request of Vice Chair Hayden. We'll let him orchestrate the presentation.
He started a conversation.
All right. Well, thank you for the opportunity here to talk about some Medicaid funding. My name is Cedric Hayden, State Representative, House District 7. I am accustomed to standing alone on some of my health care ideas, so here we go. House Bill 4146 was a concept of potential funding for Medicaid with long-term more stability and some additional distribution across a broad base, which the ACA recommends and actually requires. So I wanted to give a little bit of history for what I think we should be doing going forward, whether it's a task force or a workforce. I'm hoping to spark some ideas. I have somebody coming up from Eugene to testify on one of those ideas that will be here in a few minutes before I complete. If you go back in time, back to the 1980s, the healthcare funding mechanisms by states would use something called a donation type funding mechanism that was by hospitals, nursing homes, and other providers that would put in a portion of money and the state would match that and send that back. That went on for about a 10-year period of time. It became expensive for the federal government. They felt it wasn't very well controlled. They had a health finance administration entity that was always concerned about these donations would come in significant amounts, and then the federal government would match them. So they set up a Medicaid voluntary contribution provider specific to the provider tax in 1991. This went through several variations from 1991, but they basically established that you had to have a broad-based tax. You had to be connected to Medicaid, and through several renditions of that, they came up with 19 separate providers that could contribute to provider tax. And we're going to talk about what that provider base is today that states have available to them. If you go to the meeting materials, we have all the information from our research and backup to that, the sources. But those 19 different participants that can contribute to the broad-based tax include the hospital, inpatient, outpatient, nursing services, immediate care facilities for individuals with intellectual disabilities, physician services, home health care services, outpatient prescription drugs, health maintenance organizations. And the most common of those are the nursing care facilities, the hospitals, the managed care organizations that the states have done. And if we look at across the U.S., if we look at a couple of those states, there's one that doesn't do any, which is Alaska. So they're a little bit of an outlier. We've identified South Dakota as a state that only does one provider tax. And we've identified Minnesota that actually does six different types of provider tax.
How many do we do?
We do four on a permanent basis, and House Bill 2391 added two temporary to that. So that was the next question. But one of the things that I want to pause a moment on in Minnesota with the six different provider tax, they have a hospital, they have immediate care facilities for individuals with intellectual disabilities. They have managed care organizations, nursing home providers, ambulatory surgery centers, and wholesale drugs. One of the things that I think Oregon has not taken the time to look at is the pharmaceutical industry as being a partner in sharing the cost of our Medicaid through one of these systems.
Let's do it.
And I know we just had a robust floor debate about that. And the other one that I identified here was Michigan. Michigan is a little bit of an outlier because they have a plan that includes their insurers, but in Michigan, they actually apply that to ERISA plans. We heard a lot over the summer about ERISA plans being disqualified on a federal level, but we can look at Michigan as an example that they have a broad base all claims tax, like Chair Greenlich mentioned often in our discussions as we came up with House Bill 2391, and the discussion always turned to, but we can't do that under federal government. But the federal district court did reaffirm that they could do that. The insurance companies or those involved with the ERISA plans took that to the Supreme Court, and early in 2017, the Supreme Court refused to hear it, which ended that being the law of the land. And so Michigan has a 1% all claims type provider tax that they use to help fund their system there. So as we go forward, I believe that it's time now in 2018 to start looking ahead and considering every possibility to maximize the funding for a provider tax assessment. There are 19 different provider classes that can participate in these assessments, and the successful and feasibility of provider assessments depend on the policymakers and the effective healthcare providers working together. So even though the base bill doesn't have a purpose, and we're not voting on anything today, I think it's still incumbent upon us to have these discussions. And so I'm hoping that as we move forward, if I have the fortunate opportunity to back in 2019, that in the interim, though, while we're still here, that we can at least have a work group or something. My preference has been to have that a little bit more in the public sector rather than just the individuals that are participate. Now that we have a consumer-based tax on a temporary basis, you're actually starting to engage the populace in this rather than the just the proponents of being involved with this, mainly hospitals. So again, in the materials, the Minnesota one, we've laid out what those are. The interesting thing there is the wholesale drugs that are available under the one of the 19 plans. I think that's something that Oregon should look at. In Michigan, again, they've done the ERISA-based plans on an all-claims tax, and we provided that information for you. Oregon, what do we do in Oregon? Oregon has the hospital tax, and they have the nursing home tax on a more permanent basis. We are, in this legislative session, rolling over the nursing home-style provider assessment out longer term to 2026, I believe. But then we have a managed care tax of 1.5%, and we have a temporary health insurance tax. And although those do qualify under the 19 plans that we have available, the concern that I have with those particular plans, or that particular plan, is that, one, which I've mentioned, we don't really have public input, and in my opinion, or my perception, not really enough transparency putting that together, but the sunset. The sunset that we've all heard, if these taxes aren't there, the sunset, which is going to happen simultaneously in 2020, when the federal government reduces the amount of cost sharing on the ACA expanded population, which is 100% to 138%, that sunset creates, we know now, a $1.3 billion hole in our budget. And so I think...
Sorry, what did you say? It went from 100% to 38%?
So it goes from 100% to 138%. I may have missed the 138%. So that's the ACA expanded population. Federal government started out as being 100% of that, and then they've kind of brought that down over time to where in 2020, we believe, based on some estimates, that the ACA reduction is going to be another $170 million that the state will be required to pick that up. So if you combine those two costs, you're looking at approximately, and those are case-based, but you're looking at approximately $1.5 billion hole, a hole in the budget for Medicaid going to 2020. Will a 2019 legislative session be enough to work that out? That's my concern. So again, I'm advocating not for House Bill 4146, but to bring those partners together over the interim here going into 2019 session when we actually have some plans put together. So in our study, the interesting things that we came up is the ERISA plans actually are being used in one state. And that was kind of counterintuitive to the conversation that we had when we set up the original plan. There are an existing 19 health care provider classes that can be used. And
you don't exactly go to the ERISA plan. You go to the claims.
You go to all claims. So yeah. It is an all claims, yes.
You're not actually taxing the plan. You're taxing health insurance claims.
That's what you're doing or what Michigan does?
Michigan, we are not doing that. Michigan is doing a 1% all claims tax.
And that's essentially what I was proposing in doing here, exactly that same thing.
Well, how come we didn't do that?
Well, let's him finish him. Okay. And I'll make a comment about why we did.
I'm curious.
Let me put the background is that all legislation, all
good
legislation
about this.
Is a combination of good politics and good policy. And that's not good politics. That's bad politics because you now get all the people with self-insured plans against your plan, which includes the unions with Taft Hartley Trust and Intel. And I mean, so it has a political difficulty rather. It's obviously good policy.
Well, maybe. I mean. Okay. Well, we should talk. I mean,
I'm sorry. Okay.
We'll open it up to questions here in a minute.
You know, this is what I just said.
So, kind of finishing up with the conclusions as far as whether we do a workforce, which is the time has come and gone, or a task force, time has come and gone on that. But I think there is still time to consider a workforce to get together, some sort of work group to start discussing this. And the other thing that I want to introduce. Which I believe has value on discussing that I've been talking with some partners about is the idea of a health insurance revenue bonding, right? And everybody's going to go, what? Bonding health care? And so I have some invited testimony to come up and talk about how that might work. But if you look at some things that we do in the state of Oregon, we've got some lots of tax credits. We got the film industry tax credit that kind of works on an auction. We're proposing doing an education type tax credit coupled with some of the federal taxing that we're doing that would actually get around some of the limitations in the federal tax codes in this session. But the idea of coming up with something of a revenue bond, let's say that you had a 4 or a 6 year maturity bond in there. What we do with our provider tax now is we assess the hospitals, and I'll just use them as an example. We assess the hospitals. The hospitals participate by putting the money in. The federal government matches that money up at different levels on many different categories of clients, but it averages out to about a 3-to-1, and then that comes back and it goes through a bunch of actuarial services. Those actuarial services run those numbers, and the simple math on it is the hospital ends up with about 3%. They get kind of a 3% incentive to go through that process. If you look at bonding, much of the municipal bonds in the state of Oregon that are out there, if it was structured as a tax-free bonds, those are somewhere around 0.7% to up to a 0.5% bond. So is the idea of bonding healthcare, where you have appropriate participants putting money into and utilizing that 3% that the hospital gets as an incentive to do that, as kind of the incentive for people to buy some stable bonds in the state of Oregon, I think is something that would be worth exploring. So I will open that up to any questions if you have any.
I feel like Professor Hayden really walked us through an excellent master's level discussion of healthcare taxes and assessments.
And I also have invited testimony.
I'm trying to.
He hasn't passed the comps yet, though.
Thank you, Chair. Representative Hayden, I feel like I'm learning something completely new and some potential concepts for me to even learn more about. So I'm actually want to come talk to you some more about this. But more of an elementary question. Tell me more about what ERISA stands for and what ERISA is. If you give me just a brief description of what that.
So what as we get into some of the bonding, Randy Miller here, I'd like to introduce him. He's our expert on the ERISA plans, but they're basically plans that have some overlay of the federal government on self-insured. If a large company goes out and they self-insure, they follow under some federal restraints that are different than if I, in a business sense, go out and buy through an insurance broker.
There's a simpler answer to your question. ERISA is a program that a federal program that supervises retirement programs and other benefit programs of corporations. And the basic law says the state cannot interfere in dealing with how individual companies do their fringe.
And what does it stand for, ERISA?
It stands for the Early Retirement Income Security Act of 1974, as it's been amended over the last 40 years.
It's part of the federal tax code, and it's a body of tax law that governs employee benefit plans. I'm sorry, my name is Randy Miller, and I'm the one who invented the health insurance revenue bond. That's why I'm here.
So hang on just a second.
Okay.
Any further questions before me, and I will then turn it over.
I do have one question. I was trying to load some of your presentation on my tablet here, and I missed it. Can you explain why Michigan has been able to do the all claims, all payer, and either others of you? I think you explained it, and I really did just miss it. And why we either haven't tried it, other than maybe the political problem, or other states have not tried it as well, because I think that's pretty important.
Here, it's the political problem. I've been trying to get it since we first talked about it. That's in 2003.
So, Vice Chair Rob knows for the question, and if you, we tried to simplify this, and thank you to my staff, Austin, for helping me put this together and doing a lot of research. If you go to the Michigan part, we've kind of broke it down here, but the simple answer is that the legislature put their heads together. They actually decided, assuming a little bit here, to test the ERISA plans and the protections that that has. And it did go to the Sixth Circuit Court. And the insurance companies that utilize these ERISA protections did challenge that. And they had a broad-based plan that was, as GreenLake says, an all claims tax rather than affecting their policy or what they offer. It didn't mess with that. It just, whatever the claim was, then there was a 1% on that. They lost that in the Sixth Circuit Court, and that went to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court, in January of 2017, refused to hear it. And so
hang on. And LRO modeled that for us, and it would essentially double the base of the tax. So if you wanted to do a 2% tax on insurance claims, you could do a 1% tax on if you went to
follow up. So this is where my ignorance of how our court system works. So because the case was turned down by the United States Supreme Court, what Michigan was doing was allowed to stand.
Mm-hmm. Okay. In the ruling.
Yeah, but he overstated his fact. It doesn't make it the law of the land. It means
it's the law of the land in that area of the world.
What?
Until the Supreme Court.
So potentially we could, let me just follow up here. We could try this approach if we could pass it here and then see if we get sued, mm-hmm. and it would go up to the Ninth Circuit, and there'd be another attempt at the issue. One more follow up, and then I'll tamp down for a second.
Okay, I will.
So, go ahead.
So, yes, in that area, that is the law, and as you have said before, sometimes good policy gets challenged legally. And so there certainly with any legislation is the opportunity to challenge that. I think in this case that bring it over to the Ninth Circuit Court that they would have to look at that case law, and they would look at that case law. And so I think it gives a stronger opportunity for us to look at that.
Mr. Chair, I just want to interject one thing. Julie Pierce for the record, House District 37. So when the Sixth Circuit Court ruled on that in the Michigan case, the delineating factor was that taxation is not a management issue of a self-insured plan. States cannot come in, that is correct. The federal law definitely says states cannot come in and tell them how to manage their plan, but what they looked at was the fact that taxation is not part of the overall management of the plan, and therefore that is why that was allowed to stand.
Interesting.
One more
follow-up. Go ahead.
Comment. So I hear what you're saying about the politics. I question whether we've really tested that or not. Maybe the political climate around this would be different because some of those entities that might oppose also care about tax reform generally and about these programs. And one of the things in the Revenue Committee that we talk about is a tax that is small and broad-based is actually the best kind of tax that you can have because you have fewer anomalies is not the right word, but places where you get strange problems that occur that create unfairness. And so the smaller the tax can be, the broader the tax can be, that in terms of tax policy, that is a better way to go. And when you narrow it, you get aberrations that either create unfairness or create changes in the market that you don't necessarily want to have. And so I'm very intrigued by this idea, and I think
it was debated in this committee, I think, either 2009 or 2013.
Okay, I was still a baby
and
father
the issue
at that
was
point.
The unions came up to testify against it, and the big self-insured companies came up to testify against it.
Well, you know, I come from big labor, and big self-insured companies have been my fan lately. Maybe we can go to that well.
I think what's Representative Hayden is talking about is a process where we begin to think broader as we go forward toward 2019.
Yeah, we're just hoping that through some avenue, and I strongly feel that the clock is ticking on something that we know is approximately $1.5 billion
full Intermedicaid budget. So if there's any no further questions, I'll turn it over to Randy Miller to talk about ERISA plans potential or an opportunity to look at potential bonding type mechanism for healthcare and Medicaid.
Can you explain that a little more? I didn't hear where you were coming from.
My name is Randy Miller. I live in Eugene. My background is in underwriting, and I used to work in underwriting bond issues for state and local governments, basically putting together financings for just about everything you can think of in the public infrastructure. And then I ended up on the life and health side of the insurance business. So in 1990, I started working on this idea. And to make a long story short, the models are built on the demographics for the state of California. And it works far better than anything I ever actually imagined. So basically what I've done is that I've taken healthcare and I have put it on parity, if you will, with how the rest of the public infrastructure has been financed for decades. I'm talking about mass transportation, toll roads and bridges, nonprofit hospitals, power plants, public water and sewer systems, schools, you name it. What's unique about this is that I'm going to talk about this in the context of how the model is, in the context of the model itself, as opposed to explaining this to a consumer. In the model, the reason that this thing is counterintuitive and has stumped everybody throughout the due diligence process is that I'm showing the state of California borrowing billions of dollars, repaying the money with interest, put in a new source of revenue, repaid all the bonds, funded all the health care for all 35 million people, and in the end, the savings was anywhere from 8 to 12 digits in 3 years. That's it in a nutshell.
Just tell us how it works.
To sit here...
Well, if you can't explain it to us, then there's no point in you testifying.
No, okay. I'll explain it.
Thanks for coming.
Okay, I'll explain it. What I designed is a statewide, you would call it a universal healthcare system. Think of it as one big checking account. The simplest way I could describe this is that the difference between what I designed and how healthcare has been funded and paid for decades, like my entire lifetime, is the difference between term insurance and term life insurance and whole life insurance and permanent life insurance.
Okay.
So with term insurance, you pay a little bit here, and you get a little bit older, and the cost goes up a little bit every year. And at some point in time, probably around your 50s or so, it's going to become so unaffordable, you won't keep it anymore. And it's coverage for a stated period of time called 1 year. Permanent life insurance, you pay a much higher premium for the same coverage of benefits. And there's an equity component called a cash value.
Right.
And over the course of time, your premiums will stay level, will for the most part stay level. And over the course of time, in as little as anywhere from 5 to 10 years, the permanent policy will actually end up costing you less than if you kept the term insurance. That's the fundamental difference. So I have taken this new revenue, if you will, in the model, and I have put it on the participants. Why? Because they're the ones who drive medical inflation. Not the only reason, but it's a big factor. And in the end, there's no deficit, there's no kicking the can down the road, and there could be hundreds of millions of dollars left over.
Right, thank you. Representative Parrish, are you?
Yes, so thank you. Again, Julie Parrish, House District 37, representing Westland and Tualatin. House Bill 4146 was designed after Measure 101 to have the conversation about what we do to fund Medicaid sustainably and permanently into the future. The fact is yes, 26% of voters who turned, of the overall voting population said yes to those taxes. When you look at the overall 2.6 million people, 40% of the electorate showed up. The people who voted yes represent 25% of the electorate, the total electorate. So, but what they voted on, Mr. Chair, is a temporary tax increase. They did not vote on a permanent stable funding for Medicaid. They voted on temporary taxes that expire in the next biennium. The expiration of those taxes leaves us with
voting on what you asked them to vote on.
Well, that's what they, well, and they voted on what I asked them to vote on, sir, that came out of this body. The taxes in House Bill 2391 were temporary. So,
yeah, it's really temporary.
The temporary nature of those taxes does leave us with a $1.5 billion budget hole. People voted on temporary taxes on health care. I don't believe that they want to see those permanently, certainly not based on some of the conversations I had around the state. They're like, we'll get there with you one time, but you guys need to go back to Salem and figure it out. House Bill 4146 was supposed to be the conversation to how to figure that out. What we learned on that journey, though, was that the hospital tax assessment that we do, the 5.3%, not the 0.7 hard tax that goes to the general fund, the 5.3% closed loop assessment, whereby we borrow $100 from the hospitals, we run it up to Uncle Sam, we match it 3-to-1 to Medicaid, we bring it back down to the hospitals, they get a bonus for being the banker, and the rest goes into CCOs. That mechanism we can do with 19 different healthcare entities. We're currently doing two. We're doing the long-term care facilities, but there's a true tax element on that for actually a handful of facilities, including one of my district. And then we're doing that with hospitals, and we put the 1.5% on insurance. So let's talk about who some of those other 19 entities are. They could be retail pharmacy. They could be a surgical center. They could be a an ambulance company. The most recent healthcare data from the Department of Revenue via NAICS codes, which are the industry codes for taxation, show that if we were to use a closed loop assessment whereby they would actually get their income back, not a true tax that they would then have to pass on to consumers, if we just did that for ambulance companies and surgical centers based on 2012 data, there are actually now like 18 more surgical centers than there were in 2012, that would generate $50 million of available matching dollars that we could then turn around, run up to Uncle Sam, match, give them back their money, hold them harmless. More interesting, though, which is not in the 4146 draft bill, is the retail pharmaceutical. So this is where you go to Walgreens or Safeway or Albertsons and buy your drugs. Medicaid in Oregon last year spent $841 million on pharmaceutical. Those were largely dispensed at a grocery store or some retail outlet. So over the biennium, that's $1.682 billion. If you went up to the 6% cap that the federal government allows us to use, because they're capped at 6%, it would generate $100 million, almost $101 million that we could match for Medicaid. And we could, if we spent time, Mr. Chair, find a way to devise to make sure that those entities are held harmless, just like we do the hospitals. Now, if you were to further extrapolate that the $841 million is really spent on 956,000 Oregonians and say, okay, but there's also your self-insured who are buying health care, your private pay insurance who are buying health care. And if you gave that a weighted factor of a 2.75, assuming that somebody who maybe gets their health insurance who's young and healthy is not as sick as somebody maybe on the Oregon Health Plan, then using that same 6%, you would generate $277 million in a closed-loop assessment without ever having to raise a consumer-level tax on health care again, which would fund the Medicaid gap that we need to fund next year. So my argument is, and in asking that we get together and find a way to deliver this closed-loop assessment through other types of provider types without having hard taxes on actual citizens at the consumer level, so there are 19 different provider types. If you assessed physician groups this same way, it's over $500 million a biennium that we can bring in that could go back to those physician groups, and consumers wouldn't actually see a tax on health care. There were other ways to do this, Mr. Chair. We're arguing, I would assume Representative Hayden arguing still with me, that the goal is to find a different sustainable way to fund Medicaid for those who actually need it, who are qualified, that there's some efficiencies we need to build into the system so that we're not making coordinated care organization payments to people who, on behalf of people who no longer live here, that we look at things like cooperatively bidding for pharmaceutical. So in Oregon, with that $841 million a year, $1.68 billion a biennium in drug costs for the 16 or now 15 CCOs, if you could cooperatively bid that through the OHA and not have 15 CCOs out doing that themselves and shave 10% off of our drug costs, we're talking about $168 million savings. So right now, the 15 CCOs are not bidding cooperatively for drug costs. We should have that conversation about how to realize those savings. Yes. Mr. Vice Chair has a question. Sorry.
Well, it's more of a comment, which is, I'll just tell you that I think there's a lot of interest in getting the CCOs to do that, but
they all have their own sort of individual quirky reasons at this juncture for not doing that or not liking that idea. And at one point, Steiner Hayward in a meeting I was in was going to say, well, we're going to make them do it anyway. And then she sort of backed off on that. But I think there are efforts afoot to try to get them to do that. It's just some of them have the opportunity to purchase drugs through larger purchasing arrangements that they, and they think they get a better deal than teaming up with the other 14 or 13. I mean, so it's a good idea, but like there's a lot of complexity in this system as we keep talking about, and shoving everybody into one box isn't always easy to do.
Well, if we could get them into a 340A box, it would be very good for us.
Oh yeah, we talked about that in the prescription drug work group that I did but we didn't think we, well, that's a topic for another day.
Yeah. So, Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair.
It's not a bad idea. I'm just saying
ultimately, I don't think that's the complexity of that is the problem of the taxpayer. I think that the taxpayer expects that when we expend tax dollars for something like healthcare, that we have sharpened our pencil to as far down to the nub as it possibly is, and that they are getting a really good deal. So the profit motive of some of the CCOs for why they may or may not want to cooperatively bid for pharmaceutical, I don't think is the actual tax problem of Joe and Jolene Citizen, but that's just my own personal opinion.
You may be right.
Can I add something?
So I think that those are things we should look at moving forward so that when we come back into this next legislative session, that we aren't having a conversation about consumer level taxes on healthcare again. I will continue to protest that. And I think Oregonians deserve better from us, and they deserve a tax package or an assessment package on these providers that doesn't just last for 2 years, that we give them surety that we really are looking at a 4-year or 6-year plan moving forward into the future.
Go ahead.
I mean, again, to what Representative Parrish talked about, like, should we have an assessment on all these other different entities? I mean, that might be the right way to go, but like that would be a tough political battle. It's been a tough political battle to get the hospitals to do it, to get some of these other entities to do it. I mean, that's not an easy lift. It might be the right approach, and maybe we should assess more of these entities, but a lot of them are not here in the room to hear you discuss this, right? They would be kind of grouchy, I think. It would take a lot of work.
Mr. Chair,
the argument we make for hospitals is they're going to give you back your money. What's
that's
the
right.
problem?
If it's, and Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, if it's a closed loop assessment whereby that they all get the same sweetheart deal the hospitals get, I would think that retail drugstores probably wouldn't have a problem with that.
One more comment.
The other piece of this is at the end of the day, we can sit here and say that this is political or not political. I'm just going to be really brutally honest. The translation for that is who gives campaign contributions and who's going to help us get here
Parrish,
again.
I actually am offended by that. Okay.
All right. The problem is everything requires 3116 and 1.
Well, it does. And so if it's the right policy.
And there's plenty of people that are involved in this space that don't make political contributions, that have legitimate policy concerns about what we do or don't do, and we're trying to figure it out, and we're not doing it based on who's contributing to us and who's not. Okay?
So what's, when you say
plenty of the nonprofit CCOs have legitimate opinions about how this is supposed to work, and they don't contribute to my reelection race, okay? But I care a lot about what they think because they're providing health care to a lot of Oregonians. So stick to your policy approaches, which are legitimate, okay, and don't besmirch us because we get donations from people that don't donate to you.
Well, and
we are adjourned.
Okay.